all these media people who are all over saying that Jonathan Martin needs to stand up to Richie Incognito. You stand up to Incognito.
In the wake of the NFL bullying scandal, we consider the media's shifting narrative. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Toronto's Mayor Rob Ford finally admitted to smoking crack. Gawker Media searched high and very, very low for information.
We caught no small amount of grief from people who are upset at the idea of our giving money to drug dealers and gun runners. But money is fungible.
Also, a peek inside the world of Rupert Murdoch's media empire, complete with dirty tricks.
He calls back the person, finally reaches her at the O'Reilly factory, and says, "What the heck happened here?" And her response was, "Who are you?"
All that and more coming up.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. There are big stories, such as killer hurricanes and brand new wars, and small stories, like local burglaries or walkathons for whatever, and irresistible stories, which may be utterly insignificant, but command intense human interest. Lurid murders, say, or skydivers hurtling safely to Earth after a fiery mid-air collision, especially when it's all captured on video.
In this video licensed by NBC News, you see the divers in the second plane get out on the step preparing to jump. That plane appears to fly right on top of the first plane. There's a fireball.
That was on NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams on Monday. The next morning, Today had an exclusive with both the footage and the 11 lucky survivors, which guaranteed big ratings for Today and a chance to close the gap with its arch-rival ABC's Good Morning America. Morning TV is the most lucrative segment of network news, which is why NBC paid $100,000 for that video. But wait, isn't that checkbook journalism deemed explicitly unethical by the Society of Professional Journalists? Yep, and in the past 2 weeks, NBC did it twice. Only 2 days before the skydiver deal, The Washington Post's Paul Fahey disclosed negotiations between the network and the family of Hannah Anderson, the 16-year-old abductee in last summer's spree of murder, arson, and kidnapping.
When I got into the house, he handcuffed me and zip-tied my feet and then sat me down on the couch and told me what his plan was.
And what did he say?
He told me that he was going to kidnap me and take me to Idaho.
NBC will pay the family about $100,000 for its participation in a documentary about the crime. As for the skydiving footage, it was taken on Saturday afternoon.
By Monday morning, the skydivers are signed, sealed, and delivered to NBC.
Paul Fahey covers media for The Washington Post.
Now, what happened in the preceding 48 hours or less appears to be, and I don't know this for a fact, that a broker, a lawyer, somebody basically put this up for auction and the networks came running.
We spoke to NBC News to try to get comment, and we got a boilerplate response. I know you tried to reach them as well. How did they explain the transactions here?
In both cases, they said they were not paying for interviews, but simply licensing material that they would show on the air. Mike Robinson, who is the skydiving instructor who was on the first Cessna that got hit by the trailplane, told me that the nature of the deal was not just about the footage from the helmet cams of the skydivers. It was for interviews and for appearances and also for exclusivity. You can't go and talk to anybody else on TV except NBC News for the next 2 weeks.
And the Society for Professional Journalists says, yeah, that is unethical.
Yes, and the whole relationship is tainted by the introduction of money. Independence goes away. The source becomes a partner with the news organization. The news organization potentially could end up seeing the story only from its source's perspective. And the viewer or the reader should have profound questions about what he or she is seeing and reading.
Now, what got your attention to this story was not just that NBC was engaged in checkbook journalism, but that it was the second time in about 4 days that NBC engaged in checkbook journalism. It also paid to tell the story of kidnapping victim Hannah Anderson.
Hannah Anderson had been kidnapped by a family friend in August. Her mother and brother were murdered during her kidnapping, or perhaps before it. The man who abducted her was eventually shot by the FBI. And NBC had gotten a couple of exclusive interviews with this girl, but has subsequently entered into negotiations with Hannah Anderson and her father to produce a documentary with their cooperation. Now, I would say that the Hannah Anderson payment by NBC is even more problematic than the skydivers. The Hannah Anderson case is actually an ongoing criminal investigation, and knowing exactly what happened is a matter for the criminal justice system. For a network to be involved and tell the story strictly from the perspective of one vested interest really begs the question of whether we're getting to the truth in a serious criminal matter.
It reminds me of how in any big scandal in the UK, the British tabloids sort of divide the principals. One tabloid will pay one set of the players in a story and tell one narrative, and another tabloid will write a check to the opposing players in the story and tell an entirely different narrative, leading the readers to have absolutely no idea where the truth lies.
That's exactly the problem, is once you start choosing up sides and handing out money to one of those sides, you are inevitably going to tell that side of the story. You are now invested in that side of the story. And funny you should mention Great Britain.
It was not an accident. Why don't you connect the dots for me, Paul?
Well, this came up in the context of NBC News, whose new president of the division is from British television. Her name is Deborah Turnus. She just started in August. The stories about the payments to Hannah Anderson and to the skydivers just recently emerged. I don't know if that's a coincidence, but I think some of NBC's competitors would draw that conclusion, that this is a new era at NBC and that they are going to adopt perhaps some of the British media's tactics in covering the news.
Now, in the intro, we observed that the stakes are quite high. The Today Show at the moment is the number two morning show. Between first and second, how much money hangs in the balance?
Tens of millions of dollars. This is the most heavily contested time period that they have at stake. And you can see the context from which makes them want to pay a few $100,000 for some juicy piece of video. Six figures in television, network television terms, that's basically two commercials. They'll get their money back.
All right, Paul. I'm dispirited but grateful.
Always happy to depress you, Bob.
Paul Fahey covers the media for The Washington Post. And here's a statement from NBC about this story. NBC News is proud to have this remarkable footage of human survival for use across all of our platforms and broadcasts. Our licensing of this footage is standard industry practice and is the result of a very competitive process with other major broadcast outlets.
Speaking of checkbook journalism, let's turn back to May, when Gawker Media launched their subtly named Crackstarter project. Through Crackstarter, Gawker was trying to raise $200,000 to purchase, from the drug dealers who taped it, a video of Toronto Mayor Rob Ford smoking crack cocaine. A second tape of Ford ranting emerged this week, but that's another story. Anyway, the deal to buy it fell through, but a Gawker editor viewed it and posted about it, and in so doing, gave an opening to the Toronto Star. Having reported on Ford's antics for the past decade, the Star had suffered legal blowback. So even though Star staffers had seen the same video as Gawker, lacking the physical evidence, it was reluctant to run with the story. Gawker's Crackstarter stunt and post impelled the Star to go to print. Here's Ford last May, when news of the video, but no image of the video itself, was published.
And I have been judged by the media without any evidence.
Last week, Toronto police confirmed it had the video. So here's Ford on Tuesday.
Do you smoke crack cocaine?
Yes, I have smoked crack cocaine. Probably in one of my drunken stupors, probably approximately about a year ago.
So that was settled, but a little media dust-up followed when the Toronto Star characterized its Ford story, including the part about the video, as an exclusive. Last weekend, Gawker's feature editor Tom Skoka fired off a series of seething emails to Star publisher John Cruickshank. Skoka wrote, quote, "From day one, your paper selfishly, gutlessly, and above all, stupidly, tried to cover up the fact that Gawker had already reported the existence of the video." We got together, Skoka and Cruickshank, as reps from media old and new, for a kumbaya moment. First, John Cruickshank of the Toronto Star.
In retrospect, we shouldn't have put Star exclusive. And I apologize for doing that. Just as I didn't in a recent column where I was reflecting on the 5.5 months of incredible abuse that we've taken at the hands of the mayor, his brother, and all of what they call Ford Nation here. I didn't acknowledge that Gawker had published news of the video first, and that that had been incredibly helpful to us.
Part of what rubbed us the wrong way about John's account about the Star's lone heroism was that the only thing that changed from the Star's point of view between the moment when they were sitting on this fact and they didn't feel journalistically and ethically ready to publish a story and their publication of a story was that we published a story. Nothing else magically happened in that span of hours. And I think that that is what has been in this case a healthy symbiosis between old and new media, using their different strengths to achieve different goals.
There is a real difference. We looked at ways of trying to get the video made public. The folks that we were dealing with and we were raising money for are involved in drug smuggling and gun smuggling. And we came to the conclusion that those were not people we could be seen in our community to be giving money to.
You wrote in an email to Tom, "We had real skin in the game, as well as a large number of feet on the street. You broke a great story from a foreign country for which you bore no potential accountability should it have proven to be untrue. Nice to be you in such circumstances."
We were sued by Rob Ford during the mayoralty election, and we've been fighting that suit ever since. We've been banned from the mayor's office. He refuses to communicate with us. He's urged people to cancel the subscriptions, to cancel their ads. Gawker sits in a foreign jurisdiction without significant assets in Toronto. So there's nothing that could be seized in the case of a successful legal action. And also, if there were to be a legal action undertaken in New York, it would be under American legal conditions, which provide far greater latitude than Canadian law to report on public figures.
We caught no small amount of grief from people who were upset at the idea of our giving money to drug dealers. But we
and gun runners.
And gun runners.
Yeah.
But money is fungible. So, you know,
well,
we weren't buying crack.
So. What about this other point that Gawker made, which we've heard Glenn Greenwald make a similar point about traditional media, this tendency to sit on a story because you're not willing to take the risk and serve the public by getting it out there? I mean, assuming you know that it's true.
Look, in this particular case, it's required a tremendous amount of reporting. The reality is, this guy is so Teflon. Had we not kept up the kind of pounding and the work that we did, this would have gone away.
The video would have gone away.
The video problem would have gone away. And I think, I mean, look, the man is still in office today.
The man announced that he's running for re-election. It's amazing.
He'll try not to have any more drunken stupors in which he smokes crack. That's what he's promised the people. So it's deeply frustrating in that respect. But, you know, the information that came out confirming the existence of the tape mm-hmm. was the product of months in court getting this information out. Again, the legal system here in Canada works very, very differently and phenomenally more slowly than the American system.
One of the more incredible things from where we were sitting was the Globe and Mail rolled out this immense, deeply reported story about the sordid, drug-connected past of the entire Ford family. Clearly, this was something that they had been reporting on for a long time and just hadn't gotten around to
publishing.
Well, you see, this is another point about the symbiosis of old and new media with different constraints and ethical concerns, because if you don't feel you can publish a story, you can almost always publish a story about a story. So did Gawker give the Star, and to maybe even a greater extent, the Globe and Mail, some kind of cover for the reporting that they did?
Gawker tremendously speeded up the process by dropping their story as quickly as they did. I think, in fact, cover for the Globe came from the Star reporting.
Right.
Nevertheless, I was as slack-jawed as Tom must have been when it fell from the heavens.
The fact that his brother, who is a politician, actively in Toronto, was a hashish dealer, that was just sitting there and nobody had reported it, is nuts. It wasn't you guys who were sitting on that particular fact, but my goodness, there's something is very, very wrong with somebody's culture of responsible news reporting.
So now you're dissing Canada.
I think the constraints that John is talking about, at some point, if you're too much in love with your ethos of responsibility, you end up with press councils second-guessing your work and with politicians suing you.
It really is a different country. We are fighting for free speech, but it's in the context of a society that does think differently from your typical American social setting. And that reflects the way people think and are. So, yes, we're pushing always. I'm always looking for ways of importing American standards of fervor around free speech. But I do in the context of a Canadian audience, and I realize that I can lose the reputation I have for trustworthiness if I push too far, because it's not a New York audience.
And yet you have this guy who's your mayor.
No, exactly.
As an armchair completely. Observer of Canadian politics and culture over the last few months, it seems to me that there's probably a connection between this inclination toward right-thinking and good behavior and the fact that this monstrous thug of a bully was able to seize power and ride roughshod over everybody. You know, in the land of the passive-aggressive, the truly aggressive is king.
Look, I think Rob Ford looks a whole lot more like a Tea Partier than he does like, you know, an old-fashioned Canadian conservative. I wrote today about the difficulty of journalists in Canada dealing with propaganda instead of political speech. Do we have all the tools we need?
Wow. Thank you, guys, both of you, so much.
With pleasure.
Yeah.
Tom Skoka is features editor at Gawker. John Cruikshank is the publisher of the Toronto Star.
Coming up, lurid tales from old media, the world of Rupert Murdoch.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com. Working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. On the Media is supported by The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in media studies and media management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Former News Corp employees Rebecca Brooks, Andy Coulson, and six other defendants are now on trial for hacking the phone of missing teenager Millie Dowler in 2002. Millie was later found dead. The hacking, which her parents interpreted as Millie using the phone, gave them false hope and scandalized the nation. Here's from the BBC.
The defendants are lined up in order of the charges, some accused of phone hacking, some of paying public officials for stories, and some of hiding evidence from the police. Mrs. Brooks with all three.
To recap, Brooks and Colson were editors for the now-defunct News of the World tabloid, once a tentpole of Rupert Murdoch's media empire. The hacking scandal has shaken Murdoch's empire like an earthquake, causing parts to break off and others to crumble. However, the notable American properties, Fox TV and Fox News Channel and the Wall Street Journal, continue to thrive. And the New York Post isn't going anywhere. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik's new book, Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires, dives into the intricacies of Murdoch's holdings and character, and he finds that they contain multitudes.
And he's certainly a conservative, no doubt, but he's also a pragmatist, and he sees ways he can do business from people from the center-left, like Hillary Clinton when she was running for Senate in New York in 2000-2006, like Tony Blair in the UK. Tony Blair flew to a small island off Australia to indicate that he would show deference. Similarly, when there was the question of would the UK joined the euro, the common currency of Europe, which Tony Blair very much championed as an idea. Murdoch was dead set against it. Blair didn't change his policy, but what he did do is he says, I'll put it to a public vote. He set a major obstacle in his own path as a way of showing Murdoch that he would take his concerns into account.
Let's do a rundown of some of your scoops, David. Start with the attempts by the chiefs at the now Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal to muzzle coverage of the News of the World hacking scandal. Reporters at the Wall Street Journal determined that reporters at the News of the World had messed with their own coverage to protect themselves, but the people at the top of the journal were trying to squelch it.
Absolutely. About a half dozen times, Robert Thompson, the handpicked chief news executive at the Wall Street Journal, a fellow Australian, essentially a surrogate son to Rupert Murdoch, he tried to kill it. And then at a certain point, he kept raising the bar on what they would have to publish.
Mm-hmm.
The headline that would have been in the first paragraph was pushed way down to the ninth paragraph. It was softened. It is to the Wall Street Journal's credit that a story that was damaging to Rupert Murdoch's business interests in the UK in 2011 got in the newspaper so prominently. But it's not to the credit of Robert Thompson. He chose basically protecting his mentor over protecting the newspaper's integrity at a pivotal moment.
Now let's dig into the dirty tricks. One of the notable dirty tricks was played on a reporter for Crane's New York Business named Matthew Flam.
Flam was reporting on just a ratings bump that CNN had experienced and enjoyed in 2008. There was that hard-fought primary in Democratic Party between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and it really raised CNN's ratings vis-a-vis Fox.
Which had been the ratings leader.
Which had been crushing the ratings since about 2001. Fox didn't want this written about. They took action against Flam. They didn't respond to his request for comment. But he received an email from the private Hotmail account of a senior producer at the O'Reilly Factor. And she said, you know, I know you've been asking about this. It's true. They're flipping out here. They're going to replace the anchors at the conventions with Bill O'Reilly. It'll be the first time somebody who's an opinion host will be hosting that. It's a big change for us. He couldn't get a second source to confirm it. Finally, he said to his editors, what do I do? They said, you know, why don't we just do it as a blog post? And that was a journalistic mistake. Within an hour and a half, a top PR executive for Fox News denounced him by name, saying he couldn't be trusted. It was outrageously untrue. He calls back the person, finally reaches her at the O'Reilly Factor, and he says, what the heck happened here? And her response was, who are you? And he says, what are you talking about? I just got this email. She says, I don't know what you're saying. Similarly, there's a reporter for the New York Times, Tim Arango, who was doing a very similar kind of story about the ratings bump CNN had experienced that season. What they did was leak to gossip blogs, one of which posted a story saying Tim Arango just come back from being treated for substance abuse and had claimed that he had done soft stories about various television executives in the desperate hope to get a TV job. Well, that last part, there doesn't seem to be any truth to, but the first part actually was true. He had just come back for treatment for cocaine abuse. They did this just to wound him for something that had nothing to do in his journalism and was part of his private life.
So let's move now from dirty tricks to sock puppetry.
There's a long stretch, years, where people working for Fox News PR were not only supposed to spin and send out press releases and get good publicity for their people, but late at night, they were supposed to be on the blogs responding to every negative and even neutral blog posting, no matter how large or small the following that that post might have. So one person said she had over 20 aliases that she used to file these comments. Another person had over 100 aliases. They had to use laptops that had been bought from secondhand stores and repurposed and not purchased on corporate credit cards because their bosses didn't want it traced back to Fox News or to News Corp. They didn't just respond to the postings. They responded to other people's comments. So one PR person described getting a call being woken up at 2:30 in the morning by a woman who's now the head of PR for Fox, Irina Briganti. And she said, "Why are you embarrassing me like this?" And the person said, What do you mean, having been just woken up?" And she said, "You know, you haven't responded to comment number 67 or whatever it was on this posting."
Wow. The weird thing about Fox News is that it operates exactly the way many people think that all media operate, as a conspiracy to shape the message. A case in point, Roger Ailes, watching the election returns, decided that the channel had to change its stance on immigration. And you report that he lectured the senior staff on a conference call. Next time Sean Hannity shows up, he says,
"My thinking has evolved on immigration," something like that. You know, and when Roger Ailes says something, you can usually expect to see it show up often on Sean Hannity. I think the show that is in some ways most in sync with his outlook is Fox and Friends, the chirpy morning show that nonetheless is relentlessly on message to where Ailes wants to be.
So he's still a political guy, as he was back when he worked for Ronald Reagan. But who told Fox News Channel's talking heads to ignore the polls and keep projecting Mitt Romney as the eventual winner of the election?
I think Fox's experts and analysts got in sort of this sealed information loop. I thought it was very telling that you had people like Dick Morris, who after the election said, "Well, you know, I felt that it was my obligation to try to give hope to the Romney folks on the off chance it might actually pull something off." The actual pollsters for Fox News itself, they commissioned polls that were pretty accurate, but they didn't have those guys on very often.
I've always said that Murdoch cares much more about the health of his business than he does about any political position. But then I think, well, maybe he just loves this kind of crazy showmanship journalism. Is it all about ink? I'm just spinning my wheels in the hamster cage because I can't come up with a moral to this story.
Well, he gave a talk in 1989 in Britain at a very prestigious lecture series in which he said, "A public service is any service that you can provide within the law that the public is willing to pay for." His tabloids absorbed that to such a degree that over the decades, they dropped the within the law part. And they said, whatever the public is willing to pay for is a public service. When you lose the within the law part of that equation that Murdoch set out in 89, suddenly the lines between right and wrong become almost invisible.
David, thank you very much.
No, thank you, Brooke.
David Folkenflik's book is called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires.
Coming up, when it comes to bullying, size doesn't matter.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, another story about bullying made headlines, probably because of the characters and the locale. Not teenagers on social media, but football players in the NFL. It's easy to be outraged when the victim in question is a 13-year-old girl, but when the victim is a really big man who slams into other men for a living, the narrative isn't always so clear-cut. And according to NPR sports correspondent Mike Pesca, the media's story of the two Miami Dolphin players morphed as the week wore on.
For a couple of days, when it was reported, it seemed like what happened was that Jonathan Martin left the Dolphins training facility. Why? He was the subject of a prank gone wrong. Ribbing. The word ribbing was actually in an AP article. The Sun Sentinel, quoting unnamed sources, say that it was Martin's emotional problems that caused this to happen.
This particular position is helped along by the fact that Martin was a Stanford-educated football player who studied classics with a focus on ancient history. He was the child of Harvard grads. He's a softie.
When he was at Stanford, the story was our amazing offensive tackle, who everyone knows is great at his position and therefore a tough guy, is kind of an intellect. And coming into the draft, it was one of those stories where he was, wow, look at the dimension that this guy has. But yes, the word soft was attached to him. The story dies down a little bit, and then it comes out that it was a spat between Martin and Richie Incognito. And the word bullying was put out there, and the word hazing was put out.
The Dolphins initially released a statement saying that this notion of bullying was speculation and that the team hadn't received a complaint from Martin about bullying. Here's former NFL player Antonio Pierce earlier this week on ESPN.
Where did the word bully come from, right? It wasn't Martin. It hasn't come from that locker room. Who made up this scenario that he was actually bullied?
There was a debate, a pretty low-minded debate in some places that shouldn't be low-minded, like CNN and elsewhere, where they asked, how can a huge guy, how can a guy who weighs 315 pounds, how can he really be bullied? And then
the story evolved.
Devolved, really, when it was revealed that Richie Incognito issued death threats to him, allegedly, and used vile racist language. Many people said there's no place for this. The NFL has really got to crack down on the culture of hazing and this sort of culture. But there was another debate that went on a little below the surface, but you had a dozen players, former players, Russ Tucker, Mike Ditka, Ricky Williams, and Antron Roll, the Giants, all these guys saying, just punch him in the nose. That's the way to stand up to a bully.
We assembled a montage from ESPN Radio after the narrative shifted a little bit.
All these media people saying that Jonathan Martin needs to stand up to Richie Incognito. You stand up to Incognito. He's an insane person. He bench presses 600 pounds.
Despised by players. History as a bully. Bar fight recently. He's a thug. A bigot.
Incognito's crazy. Like, he's nuts. He's not just going to say, right now you punch the bully in the mouth, that's how you beat him. No, he's going to start terrorizing.
Those were some sports talk jocks actually saying sensible things, which I didn't hear from a lot of the athletes. And it definitely becomes the sort of thing that callers can debate and the host can give his opinion and other callers. I heard this one. You know, in my neighborhood, we handled this. You mean in your neighborhood when you were eight? Yeah. You had a lot of 6'2", 325-pound guys in your neighborhood? Okay.
And then later in the week, it seemed like the narrative may have shifted yet again. People like Tyson Klabo, who's a teammate, told reporters that Incognito is being perceived as this psychopathic racist, but he's a good teammate, and other Dolphins, so they didn't understand where this is coming from. So are we moving back now to this being Martin's problem and not Incognito's?
Well, I think what happened is that the locker room was open on Thursday, and they got a lot of quotes, and teams are always going to rally and see things as us versus them. That reminds me of a lot of the military hazing scandals where the people who are still there and are still wearing the uniform, they lash out against the accuser. Martin chose to take himself out of the situation, and Incognito was forcibly removed. Teammates sometimes trump all. Also, if you are a member of that locker room and you have a different opinion, well, you're not going to voice it, right? Because then you're seen as tearing the team apart. So they're kind of, in a way, the last people on earth that you want to ask about the broader bird's eye view. Was this bullying? Was this hazing? Does this say something about the culture?
Do you think it would have made a difference if Richie Incognito didn't have the name of a comic book villain?
But I think that his name should allow him to escape being identified, right?
Mike, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mike Pesca is a sports correspondent for NPR.
A teen gets bullied online. A bullied teen commits suicide. In September, it was Rebecca Sedwick from Lakeland, Florida. As these terrible episodes keep occurring, the coverage of them presents a simple case of cause and effect. Bullying leads to suicide. Based on the prominence of these stories on the news, we seem to be in the midst of an epidemic of fatal texting.
Rebecca Ann Sedwick was laid to rest today. Police say she took her life after getting bullied relentlessly by kids on the internet.
The sheriff's message was clear. Words can kill.
But it's not so, says the Poynter Institute's Kelly McBride, who wrote a story titled, Categorically, Bullying is Not on the Rise and It Does Not Lead to Suicide.
The narrative is like something out of an ABC after-school movie special. The mean kids bully the vulnerable kid, and the vulnerable kid, in an act of desperation, commits suicide. The overall cumulative effect of the storytelling as we recount these instances over and over again is a public misunderstanding of all of the science around bullying and around teen suicides. We're really, I think, as journalists, sometimes doing more harm than good.
Obviously, there is a small number of teenagers who take their own lives, very large percentage of teenagers who are bullied one way or another in high school. As a matter of just statistical rationality, the correlation doesn't make any sense, right?
Right. The number of teenagers who commit suicide has been relatively stable. And even among teenagers who commit suicide, certainly not all of them have been bullied. Experts in mental health will always caution medical people, reporters, parents, teachers from assigning a single causation to a suicide because it causes us as a society to not pay attention to the many factors that might contribute to unstable mental health.
Getting back to the Sedgwick case, the child takes her life. The local sheriff decides to prosecute a bunch of little kids, and the media cannot not report the story. But it's the way that the story was reported that you believe just broke all sorts of obvious rules of skeptical reporting.
So they quoted the sheriff who cited this particular incendiary social media post that one of the girls made. And he said, "What was I supposed to do? Leave her out there so that she can go hurt someone else?" That quote in and of itself implies this very simplistic understanding of teen social dynamics, that this one girl could be so powerful that she could say something mean on Facebook and somebody would then go kill themselves.
Something else that gets glossed over, as you alluded to earlier, are the particulars of the child's mental health and family history of depression or other kinds of mental illness, of family pathology, substance abuse, and so forth. Have we just missed that aspect of the story altogether?
Well, first of all, it doesn't fit with this narrative. And it also is hard material to deal with because it sounds like you're excusing the bullying or blaming the victim. You know, who wants to pile on this poor child?
And grieving parents.
Exactly. And there's some territory that just seems like it's inappropriate to wade into. And it probably is, which is why when we cover this issue, we need to stop looking at the specific cases and look at the trends instead. Because then we can talk about the fact that most teens who commit suicide exhibited multiple warning flags and how parents and other teenagers and teachers can intervene in ways that prevent suicide. Suicide is preventable. And we forget to tell people that.
I remember a few years ago, there was a suicide at a major university, followed immediately by a second suicide and a third and perhaps more. Can the media coverage of these supposed cyberbullying suicides actually make the problem worse?
Especially with teenagers. There's a couple of discrete studies that show an increase in what researchers call suicide ideation, which is getting the idea to commit suicide when you are exposed to the message that suicide was a solution for somebody else in a similar circumstance to you, which is why it is harmful to suggest that the suicide was a result of bullying. Because what we know is that many, many children are bullied, between 25 and 33% by most studies, in some studies up to 50%. Planting the idea that, hey, suicide is an answer to this problem, you could create a contagion effect. That's worse than just misinforming the public when you actually cause real harm.
Kelly, many thanks.
You're welcome.
Kelly McBride is a faculty member for the Poynter Institute.
On December 16th, 2012, at about 9:30 p.m. in New Delhi, a young woman and her male companion, on their way home from seeing Life of Pi at a mall, were picked up by one of the city's many private buses. Once on the bus, the boyfriend was bound and beaten unconscious by the six other male passengers, and the woman was gang-raped and beaten. An hour and a half later, the couple were found where they'd been dumped on the roadway. 2 weeks later, the woman died from the assault.
An angry nation has come together for justice.
In Delhi, demonstrations lasted for months, igniting, as much as any single incident could, a loud, fractious dialogue about violence against women.
There were furious protests earlier today at Delhi Chief Minister Sheila Deeksha's residence as well. And through the day, the police had to use water cannons to restrain them.
Response from the justice system was unusually fast. Within 24 hours, the perpetrators were arrested. Most cases take years to wend their way through India's courts. This took 9 months, culminating in death sentences for 4 of the 5 living defendants. The sentencing judge said, quote, "In these times when crimes against women are on the rise, the court cannot turn a blind eye to this gruesome act." OTM reporter Jamie York went to India this summer to report on what effect, if any, this crime had on India's media.
That sentencing judge signaled a breakthrough for India's justice system, where the conviction rate for rape is pitifully low. But nobody knows if crimes against women are on the rise. India has no reliable data about sexual violence that I'm aware of. What India does have is page after page of reporting on rape in the newspaper. Crimes against women, mostly urban, middle class. It certainly feels like an epidemic.
You see the papers in Mumbai. The 6 pages of so-and-so's rape.
Meena Menon writes for what might be India's most respected national daily, The Hindu. And she was part of the first real wave of women journalists in the 1980s. She began, as most journalists did then, by working nights at a Mumbai paper, monitoring the news wires and writing up breaking news until the shift ended at 2:30 a.m. But there were no trains until 3:30. So she and her women colleagues told their news editor,
"We'll do it, provided you drop us home or you give us a place to stay." So he said no. Our news editor said, "Do you want to be raped?" This was his question. And he found it funny. So I just said no. So we used to sleep on the office table.
To him, it was a joke. But in the last 15 years, as Indian newspapers and television boomed, stories about crimes against women have grown into an audience draw. And they followed pretty much the same pattern.
You're not really giving a perspective and an understanding of why this is happening and how this must be prevented.
On the occasions when a rape victim actually gets the police to hear her statement, called a first incident report or FIR, it's likely to appear in its entirety in the newspaper, sometimes with her name, sometimes without, but with enough detail, her place of work, a photo of her address, that it might as well be her name. And, it's often insinuated, that the victims are to blame. And then there's the term eve-teasing, a British holdover. It's a biblical reference in a majority Hindu country. The idea that Eve likes to be teased by Adam is a media mainstay.
It is fed in a very, very large way by Bollywood cinema.
Vrinda Grover is one of India's foremost attorneys.
The hero actually harasses the heroine, whether in public transport or on the road, and she keeps trying to shun him away. And then in the course of that song, the harassment seems to turn into a love affair. And that seems to have taken an unbelievable route in the public imagination of this country.
She says the term is constantly invoked.
The police uses it, the judiciary uses it, the media uses it. Senior leaders in the parliament joked and said, "Which man here has not stalked women?" And stalking is the way we all go around making girlfriends.
It's one of those great Indianisms, you know. We have quite a few, and this is one of them. A large number of crimes go under the rubric of eve teasing. This is one of the few newspapers where the word eve teasing is banned.
That's Meena Bagel, one of the few female newspaper editors in India. She oversees Mumbai's biggest tabloid, the Mumbai Mirror. She says the phrase eve-teasing was just one problem with the coverage. The other was that few editors had thought seriously about the line between reporting on gender crime and just printing rape accounts, short on context, long on titillating detail. Among those papers publishing first incident reports, or FIRs, was The Mirror.
I think it's out of ignorance. We use too much graphic detail. Like, I'm saying we in this newspaper, which is edited by me, I mean, we've been in the past guilty of reporting an FIR in a rape case. We did that and we faced severe flak for it, and I realized that it was huge error on our part because it was so graphic.
For her whole career, attorney Vrinda Grover has been trying to get the media to do away with terms like eve-teasing. She knows the influence they wield. She watched as the public reaction to the Delhi rape case was fanned by wall-to-wall coverage.
It shook society. That definitely shook people out of their slumber, which was important. It did start a conversation.
She saw the power wielded by the media spotlight, the benefits, and the liabilities.
People were angry. That anger wanted to hang six men, wanted to castrate six men. It wanted to respond to the endemic violence with more violence.
Likewise, if rape coverage, decontextualized but explicit, merely begets more of the same rape coverage, what is the point?
If each day you're going to only tell me, so-and-so girl got raped, so-and-so woman got raped, so-and-so girl got raped. As a woman, when I read the newspaper, when my young daughter reads the newspaper, it's actually very, very disempowering. I know that there is a large scale of violence against women. Please also tell me women are going and fighting about it. Please also tell me that women are being supported in this. Please tell me that the state structures are being compelled to do their duty.
When the coverage of rape is market-driven, it does not diminish the problem. Grover says she'll believe India's news outlets have learned something from the Delhi rape case, that they, as they claim, support women when they take on some of the most difficult aspects of Indian society.
You will have to support her even if she is saying this is marital rape. Now, marital rape is an issue which gets most people in this country into a complete flurry. We will have to talk about rape when it is taking place in conflict areas. We will have to talk about rape when it is taking place to lower caste women. We have to talk about rape when it happens with a working class woman. We will have to talk about rape when it happens during a communal conflict in which there are political parties and state powers involved. We will have to talk about rape when the Indian Army is involved. Only if we are going to talk about it across the board are we going to challenge this rape. Otherwise, it's about there are some bad men who are doing this to women. The rest of us are all right as a society.
Shoma Chowdhury has been reporting those stories for her whole career. She's the editor of Tehelka. It's one of India's few investigative magazines. Hers is a lucky position in Indian media. Tehelka focuses on corruption, women, and the poor while speaking to the powerful. But as Chowdhury began reporting the Delhi rape case, she knew that providing that larger context, missing in so many stories, might seem like moral relativism, excusing evil.
Because there is a danger of looking at causes, because then you can explain away any act of violence.
But she went to talk to the rapists' families anyway. They were extremely poor, but in a crowded city, they could see how the other half lived.
And they're these boys who are living on the skin of the city, constantly exposed to its glamour and to its possibilities, and never yet able to make an entry into it. There were times when they couldn't find money to eat, but they were all superbly dressed. They were very interested in clothes. They were very interested in music, the latest Bollywood films. And it was particularly poignant because their victim was also somebody who came from a really impoverished background, but who was really rising up the ranks of possibility, you know. So yes, their acts were demonic, but we'd be wild and stupid not to look at it and to fear what we are doing to our own cities and definitely country, which is of putting an extremely volatile, combustible material near fire. And that is of creating great desire. And yet, the only discourse became about kill them now, you know, hang them up. Why are we even having a trial?
Whether you're a journalist in India or elsewhere, you don't get to choose when public attention comes to an issue you care about. Something like the Delhi rape case happens, and you just hope you've laid the groundwork for a fuller understanding of the issue.
Right now, there is an environment where there is a focus on this issue, and it's long overdue. If people are suddenly aware that a lot of rapes happen in India, that's good. You may do nothing about it, but it stays as annoying sort of discomfort in you. And if that does, you know, you've achieved something.
Chadra Begel and Menon are part of the first chapter of women in Indian journalism. And unsurprisingly, they disagree about their responsibility to work in the service of their gender. and even about how much coverage enlightens and how much titillates. What they do finally agree on is the need to create stories that keep people reading about the most vulnerable Indians and even the ugliest facts of Indian society. This is one of those moments that catalyzes change, where journalists force India to ask itself discomforting questions. Why the crime happened? How the criminal justice system is responding? What it says about us? For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
As we mentioned a few weeks back, Jamie's been a producer at OTM for nearly a decade, where he produced some of our most memorable pieces, ones we love to replay, like his piece on the Uncanny Valley, that is, the problem Hollywood's digital wizards confront when building a human being. As Ren Wexler noted in Jamie's piece,
if you made it 95% lifelike, that was the best, that was so great. If you made it 96% lifelike, it was a disaster. And the reason essentially is because a 95% lifelike robot is a robot that's incredibly lifelike. A 96% lifelike robot is a human being with something wrong.
It was a fabulous listen, and much more than the sum of its parts, that went to the heart of human perception. Likewise, Jamie's piece on Border Radio was more than the quintessential tale of American hucksters selling salvation on the radio in the form of various gods or goat glands. In fact, it was about our shared longing to place our faith in something. We wanted to take a moment now to say a proper goodbye to Jamie, now deep into his next assignment. He was never a Dr. Brinkley hawking goat glands. He was more a Doctor Who, whose time machine was much bigger on the inside.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Megan Tian and Zach Spencer. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Doug Bressler.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.